just as suddenly as clouds might vault from the horizon, Gemma found the source of tension, grabbed it, and tracked it to its source. Calliope was laughing. Gemma remembered going with her parents to their house in the Outer Banks one summer and hearing coyotes shrieking in the night. They laughed when they killed, her father told her later, but she would have known anyway. It was cruelty set to music. It wasn't even the pleasure of the kill. It was the pleasure of pain, the pleasure of watching small things die slowly. And now here, in this bathroom, in an old airport that might as well have been hell on earth, Calliope laughed just like that. "You're wrong," Calliope said, and her words still carried the echo of something old and predatory and hungry. "You mixed it all up. You got it backward." She was still standing there with her head tilted, still staring vaguely at the ceiling. But by then, of course, Gemma knew. She wasn't staring. She was listening. And by then Gemma was listening, too. The shouts, the sharp, punctuated cries, and footsteps vibrated the floor. The stinging in Gemma's throat had been real. Smoke was texturing the air, giving it the appearance of a solid. And somewhere solid matter burned and transformed to smoke.
"What are you talking about?" Pete asked,
and Gemma could hear that he too was afraid. "You said we would die. You said you don't want to leave us." She shook her head. She was smiling in a way that Gemma had never seen before. It was as if her smile was actually consuming her face backward, trying to reveal her skull. "But you said it backward. The us won't die." She bit her lip, and Gemma tripped over the image of her own habit, her own nervous way of correcting herself. "We won't die." In Gemma's head, she saw smoke trails plumed over Haven, saw men with rifles working in the rubble. She saw fireworks leave tentacled trails of smoke across a bloody dawn sky. Crack, crack, crack. But these weren't fireworks. They were bullets that cracked sound in two when they leapt, explosively, from their long, slick barrels. They were bullets that made a lot of noise, and then killed silently. People were screaming.
"What's happening?" Gemma asked.
Her voice sounded like it was coming to her from the other side of a tunnel. Calliope finally looked at Gemma. She was radiant. And in that split second, Gemma saw that both Pete and Dr. Saperstein were wrong. Calliope wasn't an animal, and she wasn't a human either. She was something darker and older and far more dangerous. She was something deeper, a compression of matter and space, a possibility collapsed into the narrowest, narrowest place. Being, urge, energy, emotionless, unthinking, unfeeling, funneled so deep for so long that it became an explosion. She was a black hole that could take a planet apart forever, in endless slow motion. "It's starting," she said, and reached up to touch Gemma's face. Her fingers smelled like metal. Her fingers smelled like blood.
Lyra, 15. Lyra didn't like to steal from Sebastian. He was nice. He had helped them. He had resurrected Dr. O'Donnell and shown them where K6 was, only a short distance away in a place called Allentown. But she was beginning to understand that those things didn't matter. Whether he was nice or not, he had a phone that she wanted, and so she took it when he wasn't paying attention. Richard Haven had a whole building. He had his name above beautiful glass doors, and he was not nice. Being nice didn't matter, only taking did, the way animals took. They wouldn't get far, Lyra knew, before Sebastian realized that Lyra had stolen his phone. But they didn't need to get far. They didn't need distance to disappear. Being invisible had benefits. It was easy to shoplift as long as you picked a crowded store. Selim's mistake in the 7-Eleven had been to steal when there was no one around to deflect the clerk's attention, when he had, for a brief flaring moment, become visible. To edge a little too close or lean a little too hard and come away with a phone or a wallet. To pass into a restaurant and then stand up and leave again before anyone could ask that you pay. Lyra was now throwing up almost everything she ate, but that was all right. That didn't stop her. They'd agreed their best chance of getting into K6 to see Dr. O'Donnell was at night. They were thinking, of course, of Haven's security and of Selim's escape, which could never have been accomplished during the day. By evening, Selim had 2 cell phones and a new wallet of his own, plus more than $50 he'd skimmed from the tables of restaurants and cafes, and Lyra had a leather billfold and several credit cards, plus a necklace she'd found coiled at the bottom of a woman's purse when she'd dropped her hand casually down inside it. Everything she added to her backpack made her feel better, less nauseous, less dizzy. She didn't understand gravity, but she knew intuitively every bit of weight, no matter how small, slowed her, made her mind turn less quickly, made her feel less as if she might drop down into a place where no one could find her. It wasn't yet dark when they hired a car to take them to Allentown, their first time in a taxi. Though they didn't have an address for K6, the driver managed to locate it easily enough on his phone and told them the route would take roughly an hour and a half in traffic. Maybe she should have felt bad. Maybe she should have felt sorry for all the things they'd stolen. She wondered whether Sebastian was angry, whether the woman with the bright pink lips from whom she'd taken the necklace would be sad. But she didn't feel bad. They were going to see Dr. O'Donnell, and Dr. O'Donnell would make it all better. She was happier than she'd ever been, sitting in a sticky back seat that smelled like bubblegum, her backpack heavy on her lap, Selim's hand occasionally brushing her thigh, her hand, her shoulder, like a bird exploring the territory. She felt human. Didn't humans, after all, take what they needed? Wasn't that what humans like Dr. Saperstein, like Richard Haven, had always done? They reached Allentown just as dusk lowered like an eyelid. From one minute to the next, street lamps blinked on, and buildings lost form and instead became beaded strings of lit windows. They wheeled off the highway into long, bleak alleys of car lots, parking garages, blocky office buildings, industrial complexes with names like Allegra Solutions and Enterprise Data. Lyra lowered the window and smelled gasoline and tree sap, frying oil in a faint chemical tang. The taxi driver slowed, leaning over his steering wheel to squint hard at every street sign. Finally, they turned down a street identical to all the other streets except in name. On the corner, a Kmart showed off a cheerful block facade that reminded Lyra of Haven. A good sign. They kept going, past a fenced-in parking lot and a flotilla of bright yellow school buses, all sickly in the fading light and pointed in the same direction, like fish suspended in the deep. Several blocks later, the street dead-ended in a scrub of thinned-out, trash-filled woods. But as they approached, a narrow drive appeared behind a low stone wall, moving out of the shadow of the trees like some kind of optical illusion. K6 was marked by a single sign planted low in the grass. The no trespassing sign next to it was leaning at an angle and half swallowed by a hedge that had begun to lose its shape. There were no patrolling soldiers, no guard towers, no obvious security measures, just a long, narrow sweep of driveway that pointed to a simple guard hut. The institute itself was concealed by the curvature of the drive, but the distant lights winking through the overhanging trees suggested a building much smaller than she'd been expecting. Her heart began gasping, and she imagined the organ like the bird she and the other replicas had once found near A-Wing, sucking in frantic breaths. "Here," Lyra said. The driver met her eyes in the rearview mirror. "Here? You sure?" When Lyra nodded, he said, "You want me to wait?" "No," Lyra said. Suddenly her happiness broke apart. It lifted into her chest and throat and beat frantic wings against her ribcage. What if Sebastian had lied? What if he was wrong? What if Dr. O'Donnell didn't remember her? The driver turned around in his seat to peer at Selim and Lyra, as if he'd just noticed them. "You sure you're gonna be okay getting back?" "We're not going back," she said. And he just shook his head and accepted the money they gave him. Too much, probably. Lyra was too nervous to count and let Selim do the paying. They waited until the cab light became distant and then blinked out. From where they stood, Lyra could see one of Allentown's major arteries. But this road, sloughed off by the main thoroughfare, was totally without movement, except for the occasional approach of a car toward the Kmart. Haven's security had depended on its remoteness. The K6 was hiding in plain sight. No one would ever believe anything of importance would happen here, down the street from the school bus depot. They went parallel to the driveway on the shadowed side of the stone wall that continued along its length, concealed by a vein of trees that ran parallel to the pavement. They moved in silence, stopping every few feet to wait and listen and watch for security. But there was no movement, no distant voices or footsteps. Lyra should have been reassured, but instead she only grew more anxious. She didn't understand what kind of place this could possibly be. They stopped a short distance from the guard hut, edging closer to the stone wall in a crouch, hoping to be mistaken for rocks. Now they had a clear view of the K6 complex. It was a fraction of the size of Haven, 3 stories high, blocky white and bleakly rectangular. Security was tighter than it first appeared. A fence ringed at the top with barbed wire marked the periphery and made climbing impossible. Lyra noted, too, the presence of glass eyes everywhere and small glowing pinpricks like the burning embers of cigarette butts. That left only one option. They would simply have to walk in and hope they wouldn't be shot. They crouched and they waited, learning the rhythm of the traffic in and out, almost all of it at this hour, out. A sweep of headlights, the occasional patter of conversation as a guard, a woman with a sweep of blonde hair and a booming laugh, leaned down to greet the driver. The mechanical gate clanked and shuddered open, then closed again. They counted seconds, 12, 13, 14. The gate was open for anywhere from 10 to 20 seconds, more than enough time to run if they were quick, if Lyra didn't stumble. Still, they would be heading for the guard directly, and Lyra was sure that she had a gun. She thought she could even see it, a dark bulge on the woman's hip. For the first time, the whole thing struck her as funny, that they were risking their lives to get back into a facility like Haven after risking their lives to escape in the first place. "Let me go alone," Lyra said to Selim. Suddenly it seemed important to her, critical even. She would die anyway, whether pulled apart by the ricochet of bullets or by falling into holes that got ever deeper and harder to escape. Selim was white. He could go anywhere. He could continue stealing wallets and cell phones. He could drift and disappear and reappear again. There would be other girls who loved him and saw him as beautiful, human girls, who never knew where he came from and didn't care. They would do what Lyra had done with him in the hotel room. They could turn themselves into living strands of music that played together. "Don't be stupid," Selim said. "We're together." He stood up. When she hesitated, he reached back and took her hand again. "Come on." They moved a little closer until they were only a few feet from the perimeter fence and another, larger sign that announced K6 to visitors. The headlights of a departing car made Lyra throw a hand up, momentarily dazzled. The gates clanked open again and then closed. The car swam past them, so close that Lyra could make out the silhouette of a man behind the wheel, turning to fiddle with the radio. "Next one," she said. She was suddenly having trouble breathing, and after only a few seconds her feet and legs felt numb and bloated, as if they'd been submerged in freezing water. What if she ran into the driveway and then froze, couldn't remember where she was or where she was going? She hoped Selim would hold her hand the whole way, but she didn't want to ask. "No," Selim said. "We wait for a car going in. The headlights will give us time. The guard will go blind for 2, 3 seconds. He was right. They waited. She squeezed her toes. She named all the bones she could think of. Ankle, clavicle, tibia. She would have looked for the stars, too, but they were invisible behind the light smear from the city. Lyra lost track of time. Minutes went by, or hours. The parking lot continued to empty. All the traffic flowed the wrong way, but at last the car approached from the direction of the Kmart, its headlights skimming the stone wall and then latching onto the guard hut, the fence, the harried-looking trees. "Now," Selim said, as the gate began to grind open and the rhythm of conversation reached them. "How you doing? Another late one, huh?" Suddenly, Lyra found that she could not remember how to stand. She tried to shout the urge to her legs, but they didn't hear her. She was stuck where she was, and as Selim tried to get her to her feet, she simply landed knees down in the grass instead, barely missing the stone wall with her chin. It was as if her ankles had been bound together by an invisible cording. "Stand! Run! Walk!" she thought. But her body remained blankly unresponsive, filled with a useless static. It was too late now. The car was passing inside the complex, tires fizzing on the pavement. Lyra's heart was so swollen with fear she could feel it in her head, in her mouth, in the bottom of her stomach. "What happened?" Selim's face was unexpectedly illuminated. Fluid cheekbones, dark eyes. He was so perfect, so alive, and she was so broken. White cluster. Control. His blood, she imagined, was a deep and royal blue, hers dark and sludgy. "What's wrong?" Then she realized why she could see him so clearly, why every eyelash was drawn so vividly. Yet another car was coming. This time she didn't even have to tell her body to move, she didn't have to think at all. She was on her feet. Selim cursed, but he was right behind her. She made it over the fence but tripped getting over the curb. The guard had once again moved into the light to greet the driver, and she was so close Lyra could see the blunt bob of her hair cut to her chin, see her uniform straining over her breasts and revealing a narrow slice of her bra. Lyra couldn't believe the guard didn't see them, that she didn't begin to shoot. But Selim was right. With the headlights in her eyes, she couldn't see. They came at an angle, scuttling low around the back of the car, a sleek and silver thing, like an elegant fish, until they were pressed up against the passenger side. Lyra thought even if the guard couldn't see them, she would surely hear the way Lyra's breath tore at her throat. A second woman's voice, high and laughing, touched off a nerve inside of Lyra's whole body, like the memory of something bad that had once happened to her. The smell of exhaust made her dizzy. "You have a good night." The guard was retreating to her hut. The gate churned open and the car eased off its brakes. Lyra tried to keep pace, flowing through the gate at the same time the car did, but even as she stood up, the darkness stood too, the sense of vertigo and falling. She was pulled up and down at the same time. She was trying to leap over holes burning open at her feet. Her mouth tasted like gravel, like chemicals, like metal. Someone was shouting. She was at Haven and coughing blood. "Get up, Lyra, get up!" Her ideas rotated. They pivoted, and suddenly the true picture emerged. She was on the ground. She'd tripped. She wasn't at Haven, she was here at K6 in Allentown, Pennsylvania, and the person shouting wasn't a doctor, but a guard. The guard, who must have heard her fall. The silver car had stopped. A woman leaned out the window to shout, "What happened? What's the problem? I can't understand you." "Not you, not you," the guard said. But the woman in the silver car was still confused and the car exhaust kept stinging Lyra's eyes. "Those two, behind you, two kids, out of the way." Selim grabbed Lyra by the elbow. The guard was running and Lyra, still on her knees, saw the shiny polish of her boots, the walkie-talkie strapped to her belt, the gun holster. "Hey, you, hey, stop." Lyra made it to her feet, finally, just in time. But Selim's hand was torn free. She lost him. They started off in different directions. Now she heard the crackle of radio interference and the guard shouting again, and at the same time, Lyra hurtled to the left. The car decided to turn too. She was blinded by a funnel of white light. She saw the grill leap toward her shins and she couldn't turn. She had no time. The car hit her, or she hit it. She cracked against the hood, rolled off an elbow, and went down. A woman screamed. Selim shouted to her, but she couldn't call to him. She was on her back now, breathless, beneath a starless sky. She couldn't move at all, couldn't feel her arms or legs. Maybe her spine had snapped. Maybe her head had rolled off her body. A car door opened and slammed closed. Footsteps, muted voices, an explosion of radio static and distant voices communicating in a slang patter. The headlights made a halo of her vision. Someone came toward her. Selim? The guard? But in the high beams, faces became formless shadows. "Look at her, she's just a girl." It was the driver, her voice like a hand that tugged at an ancient memory. Haven and clean sheets and pages that turned with the soft hush-hush of wind through the grass. Then, "Oh my God." My God! The guard was talking into a radio, so many words that they themselves became static bursts. That's right, just two kids, some kind of prank. The girl's down, the boy beat it when I tried to grab him, looks like he headed into the parking lot. I know her. Do you understand? I know her. Fingers cool on Lyra's cheeks. The woman slid like an eclipse across the blinding bright lights. Her hair was dirty blonde and gray and loose and tickled Lyra's face where it touched her. She belongs to Haven. I'm sure of it. I'm absolutely positive. Lyra fell. She sank toward a warm and forgiving darkness. The pavement softened beneath her back. The night dissolved into a memory of other nights and other places. Can you hear me, hun? Can you hear my voice? Open your eyes if you can hear me. She thought she opened her eyes. It didn't matter anyway. In the dark behind her eyelids, she saw a face so familiar, so often recalled. The freckles and the wide, flat mouth, the smile that said, "Welcome, I love you, you're home." She must have hit her head bad. Her name. I wish I could remember. She was one of the earliest ones.
What?
Dim voices trailing across her mind like distant comets. One a flinty blue, one the soft white dazzle of a shooting star. We named them. Some of the replicas. It was a game we played. They only had numbers before. It wasn't Cassiopeia. What was her name? Lyra. Lyra thought. She opened her mouth. Her words evaporated into bubbles of air. Jesus, looks like she's trying to talk. The woman leaned closer. Her hair tickled Lyra's cheekbone. What's that, honey? She whispered. Lyra. Lyra managed to say, and the woman cried out softly as if the word was a bird, some soft thing that had landed in her palm. Lyra, she said. Of course. Can you open your eyes, Lyra? Lyra did, surprised by how much effort it took. The pavement hardened beneath her again. There was pain in her ankle, a sharp pain behind her eyes. Her mouth tasted like blood. Do you remember me, Lyra? My name is Dr. O'Donnell. I knew you at Haven. Remember? She reached up to touch Lyra's face. Her fingers smelled like lemon balm.
Gemma. 16. Then a bullet blasted through the bathroom door, ricocheted off the counter, and blew the pinky finger off Gemma's left hand. It was the craziest thing. One second she had five fingers, and the next her pinky was missing and blood had patterned the linoleum. And yet, at first, she knew it had happened only because of how Pete began to shout. For a long, watery second, she floated somewhere outside her body and observed the blood and the missing finger and the raw, exposed muscle of her hand with a kind of detached curiosity. And then the pain came, like a gigantic rubber band that snapped her back into the bathroom, into her body. It was pain like nothing she'd ever known, like the kind of high vibration that could shatter glass, like a full-body flu that burned even in your bones. She couldn't even scream. She couldn't try and stop the bleeding, couldn't move, could only stand there staring like an idiot as the blood kept pooling at her feet. Somehow she ended up on the floor. She wasn't sure whether time had leapt forward or she'd simply, for a half second, lost consciousness. She no longer had the strength to stand up. All this happened in 3 seconds, maybe quicker. When she did finally speak, she could only say, "My finger," over and over. But then Pete had found a roll of toilet paper, from God knows where. The girls' room never had any. And he was frantically unwinding it, half the roll at one go, and pecking it against the wound. The pressure triggered a new surge of pain and brought her stomach into her mouth. He wrapped a fist around her hand to staunch the bleeding. It hurt so much she wanted to pull away, to yell at him to stop. But the pain had her in a chokehold now, and she couldn't.
"It's okay, Jim. You're going to be okay,"
Pete kept saying. He looked as if he was going to cry.
"Deep breaths. You're going to be fine. I know it hurts, but you're going to be okay."
Another bullet blasted through the door, this time punching out one of the overhead lights. Calliope ducked and scuttled beneath the sinks as a spray of plastic and glass sifted down on them like a snow. Still keeping her injured hand wound tightly in his fist, Pete put an arm around Gemma, herding them inside one of the bathroom stalls. She leaned against the hollow of his chest, and he whispered, "It's okay, it's okay, it's okay." So many times the word and his heartbeat became confused in her head, until she heard in its rhythm that same exact message. The initial shock had passed, and already her body was working to absorb the pain, accept its reality, to find equilibrium inside it. A process she knew intimately after so many hospital visits, so many surgeries and scars. She missed her mom with a sudden sharpness even worse than the physical pain. How she sat next to Gemma's hospital bed whispering, "It's gonna be okay, I'm here," just like Pete was doing now. How she'd climbed into bed next to Gemma, making a seashell curve of her body, and the two of them would fall asleep. She missed her mom and wished more than anything that she could say she was sorry. She'd been so angry with Christina that they had barely spoken in weeks, and Gemma could see the way it was killing her mom, coiling her down around an internal misery like a winch. And now it was too late. They would die here. She closed her eyes and tried to hang on to an impression of her mom's voice, soothing her to sleep. "Hush, hush." It was Calliope's voice she heard instead. During a break in the rhythm of gunshots, Calliope came toward her. She moved quickly, propelling herself with her palms and sliding belly down on the floor with the sinuous grace of an eel. Gemma, still half-blind from pain and shock, was repulsed. The gunshot started again, and Gemma found herself briefly fantasizing about a bullet cleaving Calliope's head in two, or just evaporating her, as her finger had been evaporated. Calliope crowded into the stall with them and began touching Gemma, stroking her arms, her wrist, her thighs. "Hush, hush. There's no reason to cry," she said. "It's a finger, just a little finger."
"We need to get out of here," Pete said.
He hadn't let go of her injured hand, not for a single second, but already the toilet paper was nearly useless, soggy with blood.
"She needs a doctor."
Calliope looked briefly annoyed.
"She doesn't need a doctor," she said. "I'll take care of Gemma, don't worry. Just as soon as it's over."
"This isn't one of your fucking games."
Pete's voice edged toward a shout.
"She's hurt. Can't you see that? She needs help."
Gemma wanted to tell him to be quiet. They would be heard. They would be found. They would be killed. But she couldn't. She didn't even know who to be afraid of. She was as terrified of Calliope, of her strange little smiles and the light touch of her fingers, as she was of the guards who were shooting, still shooting. She heard screaming and pictured hundreds of replicas simply mowed down where they were sleeping, a surf of blood rising, coming to drown them all.
"It's not a game," Calliope said, and she drew away from Gemma, looking hurt. "It was never a game. But you can't leave now anyway, not until it's sure."
"Not until what's sure?" Gemma said. Her voice sounded as if it had been punched through with holes. Calliope chewed the inside of her cheek and didn't answer. She was angry, Gemma knew, because Pete had yelled at her.
"Please, Calliope." "It's like Pinocchio, like I told you," Calliope said, sounding almost bored. "He got swallowed up, so he started a fire to get out."
She held up her left hand, turning it, admiring it from several different angles. Then she began to touch her pinky finger, bend it and flex it, as if to see whether it too would evaporate now that Gemma's was gone. And yet each time she moved or stroked her finger, Gemma felt a phantom stirring in her own hand, and a new wave of triggered pain.
"You started a fire?" Gemma said, trying to hang on to the thread, to stay focused, to make sense of the nightmare. They'd been so close to being released.
"I didn't," Calliope said, still sulking.
"Some of the other thems did."
Gemma remembered feeling earlier tonight, as she and Calliope wove through a slum of bodies and filthy mattresses, that the replicas weren't sleeping, only pretending to. She felt suddenly dizzy. How many replicas were there in the airport? 500? 6? More? And maybe 3 dozen, 4 dozen guards, a handful of doctors and nurses. "Wayne thought he taught me something about fire because of his friend Pinocchio," Calliope said, with new scorn in her voice that made her seem older. "But I knew about fire forever. When I was little, there was a kitchen fire, and we didn't use the stew pot for days."
This was your idea?" Gemma asked. She remembered what Dr. Saperstein had said.
The replicas can't feel loss or love or empathy. To them, there is surviving and not surviving, and that's it. Calliope ignored that question.
"The people always think we don't remember," she said. "They think we don't pay attention, that we don't listen, that we're all soft in the head. But I've been listening. I know plenty. I know how to use a gun."
Immediately, as if in direct response to that statement, another quick-fire burst of rifle fire just outside the bathroom sent terrible echoes through Gemma's head and the back of her teeth. She heard a man's voice shout, a plea, a call for help. She wasn't sure. And then another gunshot. But the voice was enough. She had recognized it, and her stomach pooled all the way down in her feet. A terrible, sick helplessness, like having to sprint for the bathroom. It was Wayne's voice. Wayne on the ground. Wayne crying for help. And though Gemma couldn't feel sorry for him, she knew what that must mean. The replicas had taken control. They were taking revenge.
"It's always fire, isn't it?" Calliope said then. "In all the stories, there's always a fire. Does it hurt to burn, do you think?"
And she turned back to Gemma, eyes bright and big and curious, and not unhappy at all.
Lyra, 16. Lyra woke up and for a confused moment thought she was back at the Winston-Abel Mobile Home Park. In the distance she heard the thud of music and people laughing, the scattered catcall of loud and joyful conversation, but it was too clean and it didn't smell right. When she moved, she thumped her head on the arm of a sofa. "Sorry for all the noise." When she heard Dr. O'Donnell's voice, Lyra remembered the car, the driver, the cones of light, and Dr. O'Donnell's hair tickling her face. She turned and a flock of birds took off in her head, briefly darkening her vision. She must have cried out without meaning to because Dr. O'Donnell reached out and touched her cheek. "Poor thing," she said. "We wrapped her ankle up nice and tight. It doesn't look broken to me, thankfully." Lyra noticed then that her ankle had been wrapped tightly in tape, and various cuts and bruises had been treated with cool touch. It had left a shiny film on her elbows and shins. "Is this K-6? She asked. The room looked nothing like a hospital. There was a desk cluttered with belongings in one corner and shelves filled with books. A miniature fridge hummed in the corner and a stuffed bear wearing a No. 1 Boss shirt gathered dust on top of it. Lyra was lying on a scratchy, dark wool sofa. There were framed posters on the walls, giant posters of people she didn't recognize. There was a clock on the wall and a paper calendar with cats. There were no keypads on the doors, and the only lock was the handle variety. "This is part of it," Dr. O'Donnell said. She wasn't even wearing a lab coat, just jeans and boots and a light sweater. Maybe that was why Lyra felt so shy around her. That and the gray in her hair, the lines around her eyes, the sharp angle of her nose, all features Lyra hadn't remembered. She had changed, or she was different from the start, and either way, Lyra was nervous. "We're a small operation. We keep a staff of just under 150. That includes the cleaning crew." She smiled. Then Lyra remembered Selim, the way he'd veered off in the darkness when the headlights swept him and the guard radioing for backup. "Where's Selim?" she asked, sitting up and blinking at another rush of birds in her head. "Selim? Is that what you call him?" "That's his name," Vera said, and felt anxious for reasons she couldn't exactly say. The laughter, the distant drumming of music, a faint smell of alcohol, maybe it all stirred memories of Haven Christmas parties, when the researchers would remove their shoes to slide down the halls in their socks, and the air was edged with a taut, superficial tension, like the lip of water in a glass about to overflow. "Don't be afraid," Dr. O'Donnell said, and that, at least, reassured her. Dr. O'Donnell still had that skill. She could look at something or someone and understand. He looked hungry. "Sonia, she's my research assistant, went for pizza. Selim's probably halfway through it by now." Her smile made new wrinkles appear and others collapse. "Are you hungry?" Lyra shook her head. She was dizzy and nauseous and thirsty, but not hungry. "I'm sick," she wanted to say. "Help me." But she was too shy. She wished Dr. O'Donnell had been wearing a lab coat, wished she'd looked more like a doctor, and that the room looked more like a hospital. Here she felt her sickness was a stain, that it would be terribly out of place. Dr. O'Donnell got a bottle of water from the miniature fridge, which was also stocked with Diet Cokes. "Drink this, at least," she said, once again as if she'd read Lyra's mind. She took a seat, and Lyra was aware of how closely Dr. O'Donnell watched her drink, no doubt taking note of the way Lyra's hand shook. But Dr. O'Donnell didn't comment on it, and she didn't offer to help, either. "I still can't believe it's you. Number 24, wasn't it?" Lyra nodded. It was strange to hear the words out loud, even after only a few weeks, strange to think of herself again that way, one of a series, something that could be stacked or arranged. Dr. O'Donnell was watching her. "A green, is that right?" Lyra nodded again, this time because her throat seized. "And Selim?" Dr. O'Donnell said. "Is he a green too?" "Selim is a control," Lyra said, surprised the words brought a bad taste to her mouth. She was expecting Dr. O'Donnell to look sorry for her, and was glad she didn't. But she was also confused. Did Dr. O'Donnell know what that meant? Did she know that meant Lyra was dying and Selim had to watch? Dr. O'Donnell was good, but she had known about the sickness. She had known about the variants and the prions and the holes opening up in Lyra's brain, and she had lied, like all the others, and claimed that Haven existed for the replica's protection. But maybe Dr. Saperstein had forced her to lie. In the silence, she heard a new swell of music. Someone shouted, "Turn it up! Turn it up!" And there was laughter. "Is there always music here?" she asked. Dr. O'Donnell laughed. "Sometimes. Not usually so late, though. Some of the staff members are celebrating tonight." She seemed to hesitate. "We had some good news today." Lyra waited for her to go on, but she didn't. It was, she realized, the longest conversation she'd ever had with Dr. O'Donnell. "What kind of good news?" Dr. O'Donnell looked surprised. She didn't know that Lyra had learned how to ask, how to say please and thank you, how to put on mascara and speak to males, boys. "We'll be able to continue our work here," she said carefully. "We had, well, call it a contest. K6 was up for an important award, and we won." "Award." Lyra held the word on her tongue and found it tasted like coins. "You mean like money?" Again, Dr. O'Donnell looked startled, but almost immediately she was serene again, and Lyra thought of a stone disappearing beneath the surface of a still pond. "Yes, like money." She pronounced the word as if it were unfamiliar to her, but more than that, support. People who believe we're doing the right thing. Lyra wanted to ask her about a cure, and about whether Dr. O'Donnell knew how to cure the twisted shapes deforming her brain. But before she could, Dr. O'Donnell leaned forward and took her hands, and Lyra was startled by their dryness, by the coolness of her touch, both familiar and totally foreign. For some reason, she thought of Rick and felt a strong impulse to run, to backpedal into the darkness, to rewind the miles they had covered and return to Winston Abel. But almost immediately, the impulse passed, and she couldn't have said where it had come from. Rick was gone. The past was gone. Dead. You had to sever the lines and let it float off on the ocean, or you would simply sink with it. Tell me what happened to you, Lyra. Dr. O'Donnell said softly, tell me everything that happened. It's important. Haven burned down? She said simply, everything burned. She waited for Dr. O'Donnell to express surprise, but she didn't. I heard, she said finally when Lyra said nothing more. It was in the news. And besides, Dr. Saperstein, well, we stayed in touch, in a manner of speaking. But a shadow had crossed her face, and Lyra knew enough now to read Dr. O'Donnell's unhappiness. They had always been fighting, Dr. O'Donnell and Dr. Saperstein. Most of what they'd said was above her head, full of scientific words that had washed over her like breaking water. But there had been one memorable fight about the rats, and whether or not the replicas should be allowed to have some toys and games. Still, if Dr. O'Donnell had left Haven because she wanted to help, why hadn't she come back when she heard about the fire? Lyra was having trouble pinning her ideas of Dr. O'Donnell down onto the face in front of her. That was always the problem with faces, with bodies. They told you nothing. Like the genotypes who looked the same but acted completely different. Cassiopeia was proud and strange and angry, but she collected seashells. She scooped insects from the path so they wouldn't be stepped on. Then there was Calliope, who would catch spiders just to pull their legs off one by one, who'd once stepped on a baby bird just to hear it crunch beneath her shoe. Selim escaped with me, Lyra said. We ran and hid. We didn't want to go back to Haven. They were making us sick. She waited for Dr. O'Donnell to apologize or say that Dr. Saperstein had forced the doctors to obey, but she just said, that was weeks ago. Where have you been all this time? She seemed truly curious. Who fed you? Who gave you clothes? Who brought you here to see me? It annoyed Lyra that Dr. O'Donnell assumed someone else had brought them. She didn't want to tell Dr. O'Donnell about Gemma or about Rick. They were hers. She decided suddenly, like bed number 24 had been hers, like the little prince had been hers after Dr. O'Donnell gave her a copy. No one, she said. Her voice sounded loud. We came ourselves. We took the bus and a taxi. We slept where we could, and we took what we needed.
You mean you stole it?
We took it. Lyra was more than annoyed now. She was angry. Everybody else has things. Why shouldn't we? Dr. O'Donnell's cell phone was sitting there on the counter next to a coffee mug ringed with lipstick, and this infuriated Lyra more. It was evidence, proof. People take things all the time. They took what they wanted from us at Haven, didn't they? Didn't you? She didn't mean to say it, but the words came out and she wasn't sorry. She was happy when Dr. O'Donnell released her hands, happy to think she had caused Dr. O'Donnell pain. But when Dr. O'Donnell spoke, she didn't sound upset. She actually smiled. You're tired, she said. You're sick. And of course you're right. You're right. And Lyra couldn't understand it, but Dr. O'Donnell began to laugh.
Gemma. 17. They had to move. The smoke had sniffed out the corners and ceiling, and it rolled down now in heavy waves, turning the air gritty. Gemma didn't know where she'd read that during fires most people don't die from the fire itself, but from inhaling too much smoke. Even now her lungs felt heavy, wet, like a towel soaked through with rain. It's okay now, Calliope said, and the words were so absurd that they came to Gemma like sounds in a language she didn't know. It's okay now. The pain in her hand was a rhythmic throbbing, and she thought it must be her pulse beating out her blood. When they stood up, she saw a butterfly pattern of blood, absurdly red, soaking the toilet paper. And so much of it. It was insane that it should all have come from her, that she would have so much to begin with. She was freezing. She remembered then, a bath when she was little, maybe 8 or 9, and hearing her parents begin to argue. She'd stayed there, motionless, until the water was freezing. She didn't know why, in retrospect. She hadn't just drained the tub. But it hadn't occurred to her. If she didn't move, she'd thought, she wouldn't exist,
and if she didn't exist, she could stop hearing them.
You're okay, Gemma.
Pete kept his arm around her, even when he bent to cough. His eyes were tearing up.
It's going to be okay. I promise.
He was using the same sounds as Calliope, and none of them made sense, and she couldn't stop laughing, laughing and shivering.
She needs a doctor,
he said. Shouted it, actually, his throat raw from smoke, as if he expected someone to hear. Calliope was at the bathroom door. She touched the handle lightly with a finger to feel if it was hot. There are no doctors, she said. Only then did Gemma realize that there were no more shots, no more sounds of gunfire, just the noise of fire getting fat on drywall and ceiling panels and support beams, gobbling up filthy rugs and mattresses, swelling itself with sound. They never told you that about fire, how loud it was, as if everything it touched started to scream. Outside the bathroom, Gemma was relieved to find no fire. She could hear it close, though, the pop and boom of things changing form suddenly, exploded from solid to gas, a noise that sounded just like terror. But the smoke was even worse, so bad she could hardly see, and a single breath made her choke.
"Get down," Pete said.
He had to repeat it before she understood. In a crouch, he took off his shirt and wound it tight against her fist, since the toilet paper had begun to come apart. They went, crawling, Calliope in the lead. Gemma wanted to leave Calliope. She wanted Calliope to vanish, to disappear into the smoke like a mirage. But she was also terrified of losing her. She would never be able to find the exit. She couldn't think at all, didn't know which way the stairs were, thought that everything had burned already, the doors and windows and the way out, that they might be crawling their way to an exit that no longer existed. In the stories, there is always a fire. The floor was slicked with blood, and there were bodies everywhere. Gemma wondered whether one of them was Wayne's. She had the urge to shout for everyone to wake up, to run, to get out. Although she knew they were all dead, replicas and soldiers, humans born by chance and by design, all of them sleeping together under a veil of smoke. She was glad that the darkness softened dead bodies into shapes. Already they were losing reality. But she had to crawl around a dead replica who'd lost half her head to a bullet. She still had a gun in her hand, and Gemma noticed her fingers, long and pale and lovely, and imagined that they still stirred, like underwater plant life moved by a current of water. The stairwell was impassable. Even the door marked Authorized Personnel was warm, and Gemma could hear the fire beyond it humming, shredding the physical world into vibration. Calliope tested the door handle, then quickly pulled her fingers away and sucked them into her mouth. Trapped. They'd waited too long to get out. They headed back across the scrum of debris, of broken bodies and cotton drift. Everything was dark with ash. Everything looked like the grit of burning. And even as they made it to the windows, the fire finally punched its way up to the second floor, collapsing a portion of the wall near the stairwell and tonguing its way over the blood-sticky floor. A sudden sweep of fresh air made Gemma want to cry. Several windows were missing where people had crashed through them. Gemma, Pete, and Calliope leaned out into the night air, still fizzing with rain, and in the distance, Gemma saw dark figures escaping into the trees, pouring through the open gate, shaking the fence to dismantle it. Replicas, hundreds of them, making a run for it. Two vans were on fire and half a dozen bodies, soldiers and replicas it looked like, were scattered across the parking lot, like dolls abandoned by a careless child. Most of the usual jeeps and trucks were missing. Probably the soldiers had gone, carrying their wounded, or maybe seeking reinforcements, and whisked Saperstein and the other staff to safety.
"We're going to have to jump," Pete shouted. "It's the only way."
Gemma nodded to show she understood. The drop was 20 feet, and almost directly beneath them, two replicas lay, half-naked and entangled, their eyes unblinking, exposed to the wind and rain. She didn't know whether they'd landed wrong or been shot,
But it didn't matter. She would have jumped if the distance was twice as great, would have catapulted into the air without looking back. Anything to get out, to get away, as far from the chokehold of the smoke and the fire feeding off bits of skin and scalp and hair as possible. She jumped. She was screaming through the air, and her lungs were bursting with the joy of oxygen, and then she landed hard in a barren patch of dirt next to a scrub of bushes. Her right ankle rolled, and she knew right away she'd twisted it. But the pain was nothing compared to the red funnel fire that burst in her vision when she drove her injured hand down into the ground for balance. It was like the missing finger had instead folded up inside her and shot all the way to her throat. She nearly gagged. Pete landed with a grunt and scrabbled quickly away from the bodies. Now that Gemma was closer, she saw they'd been shot, probably from the air. There was a pattern of blood spatter on the exterior wall. It was Calliope, funnily, who hesitated, teetering on the windowsill, looking now not like the monster Gemma had seen in the bathroom, but like a sister Gemma might have dreamed. Smoke undulated and roiled behind her. "Jump!" Gemma found herself shouting, though minutes earlier she'd been hoping Calliope might simply disappear. "Jump!" Her throat was raw from smoke, and when she tried to draw air again, she began to cough. Calliope jumped, and for a second Gemma saw her framed in the air like a bird, arms flung wide and mouth open, suspended in the glitter of the fine rain. Then she landed, gracelessly, but on her feet. Gemma felt the impact herself, whether from the vibration of the ground or because of the doubling effect she didn't know. When she stood up and tested her weight, her ankle held, barely.
"What happened?"
Pete had already moved to take hold of her injured hand again, but she drew away. It was too painful, too awful, and numbly she half believed she could make everything that had happened untrue again. "I landed wrong," she said. "It's nothing."
"Keep pressure on your hand," was all he said.
He'd always looked thin, but now, in the slick light of the remaining street lamps, covered in blood that wasn't his, he looked truly sick. They moved across the parking lot, leaving the ruins of the airport behind. Gemma kept expecting to hear a ricochet of shooting, to be stopped, to have her legs eviscerated by bullets. But other than the sound of the fire and a few distant shouts, it was quiet. Why was it so quiet? The fire must be visible for miles. Shouldn't there be sirens already? Ambulances? Shouldn't someone have noticed and responded? It was as if they were miles away from anyone. It felt to her that they were in the open forever, inching across that bleak expanse of gray pavement, with the painted silhouettes of old parking spaces still faintly visible, and bodies flung at intervals face down on the concrete. But finally they were at the woods, which would hold them and hide them, and at the far end of the woods would be roads, and gas stations, and telephone wires, and help. Then an explosion made waves of sound that made the ground shudder and vibrated in Gemma's teeth as she turned around. A portion of the roof had collapsed, and flames shot suddenly to the sky, illuminating a low-hanging covering of red-tinged cloud, before retreating again. Gemma and Pete stood stunned, watching the last of what had once been science's greatest experiment consuming itself. Only then did Gemma see Calliope a short distance away, standing next to a sedan leaning on a flat tire, windshield shattered. It had obviously been heading for the gate. Gemma couldn't see Calliope's face, but she was strangely immobile, as if something inside the car fascinated her. And for whatever reason, Gemma found herself backtracking, limping on her injured ankle. Forever afterward, she couldn't have said why she was compelled to the window of that sedan, only that she was. When she was still 20 feet away from the car, Calliope leaned in through the open window. Gemma couldn't see what she was doing, but she thought she heard a shout. This, too, she couldn't absolutely swear to afterward. By the time Calliope withdrew, Gemma had come up beside her. It was brighter now.
The burning airport had created an artificial dawn. When Calliope turned, Gemma nearly screamed. Her hands, her wrists, her shirt, all of it was soaked in blood. "I tried to help him," Calliope said quickly. "It was too late." For a moment, Gemma couldn't make sense of what she was seeing. A confusion of glass and blood and steel, the horrible staring face, and the metal finger jointed to its forehead. It looked like one of the cubist paintings her father collected, a nonsense jumble of shapes. Then, in an instant, she understood. The blood leaking from his mouth, the airbag pinning him to his seat, a steel rod that must have rocketed from the building just before the roof collapsed, whipped through the windshield, and punctured Dr. Saperstein between the eyes. His glasses were gone. In death, he looked surprised and vaguely puzzled, as if he'd come across an unexpected turn in a familiar road. "Poor Dr. Saperstein," Calliope whispered, and almost sounded as if she meant it. What had she been doing when she leaned into the car? Why was she so covered in blood? Gemma turned to look at her. Calliope's face rapidly shuddered into an expression of disgust. Like a mirror, it rearranged itself to reflect back what it saw. It was very fast and extremely convincing, but Gemma had caught her too early, had seen the truth nesting like an insect beneath her skin. Of course, that was the problem with simulations. They were never exactly like the real thing.
Lyra, 17. After a dinner of salty soup and crackers that dissolved in the broth, Lyra worked up the courage to tell Dr. O'Donnell what she had come for. She wanted to live. Dr. O'Donnell listened in silence, resting one hand lightly on Lyra's knee. Lyra should have felt happy because Dr. O'Donnell was obviously so happy to see her. But a shadow had attached itself to her thinking. Everything dimmed beneath it. Why hadn't Dr. O'Donnell come to help? Why did she allow the doctors to make all the replicas sick? What was K-6? That there were no hospital beds but only sofas and armchairs and cork boards, where the doctors wore jeans and sneakers and music played at midnight. She was reassured, however, when after a long pause, Dr. O'Donnell stood up. "Wait here," she said, and slipped out the door. When she reappeared, she was holding a small, unmarked bottle of fluid, along with one of the long-snouted syringes Lyra had despised back at Haven for their cruel curiosity. Now she was relieved to see it. "What is it?" Lyra asked. Dr. O'Donnell found a pair of medical gloves at the bottom of a desk drawer and cinched them carefully on her fingers. "A new medicine," Dr. O'Donnell said. She drew the liquid carefully into the syringe, keeping her back to Lyra. "Very rare. Very expensive." "Will it cure me?" Lyra asked. Hope buoyed her, swelled her with air, and made her feel as if she might lift off toward the ceiling. "Will it make all the prions go away?" "With any luck," Dr. O'Donnell said. Then, "Hold out your arm for me." Dr. O'Donnell offered Selim a couch in the office next to hers, which belonged to a beautiful woman named Anju Patel. But in the end, since Selim insisted on sleeping next to Lyra, Dr. O'Donnell and Anju maneuvered a second couch into Dr. O'Donnell's office instead. "Sorry if there are any crumbs in the cushions," Anju said. She had appeared suddenly, practically careening through the door, wearing sweatpants and an inside-out T-shirt, as if she'd dressed in a hurry. Lyra had overheard Anju tell Dr. O'Donnell she'd been in bed when someone had rung her up to share the news of Lyra and Selim's arrival. The medicine had filled Lyra with a kind of happy warmth. Already she could picture the prions breaking apart like mist by the sun. "Cupcakes are my coffee. I need at least one a day just to keep moving." Anju turned to Dr. O'Donnell. "Sorry, do they understand me?"
"We understand you," Selim said. "You like to eat cupcakes?"
For some reason, his voice made Anju startle. Then she began to laugh.
"Oh, God,"
she said. She had tears in her eyes soon from laughing, though Lyra didn't know what was funny.
Yeah, I do. I really do.
After Dr. O'Donnell had cleaned and bandaged the cut on Selim's cheek and set him up with an ice pack to help reduce the swelling around his eye, she left in search of Advil and something to help Selim sleep. Anju Patel stayed staring. Her eyes, dark as the nicotine candies Rick had sucked sometimes, were enormous,